Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I'm Matt Sainsbury, Editor-in-Chief of DigitallyDownloaded.net, and with me this week we have two people. Hello, Ginny, how are you?
I'm all right. Had a bit of a big night.
That's good. That's good. It's always good to podcast hungover. And speaking of hungover people, hello, Harvard.
Good morning.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I'm pretty hungover.
That's how committed we are to this podcast. We all drag ourselves out of bed when we should be nursing our heads and recording. Yeah, that's how dedicated we are. We're really good at this. All right. You know, you'd think that we would not like drink the night before a podcast, but you know, that's just crazy talk. All right, so let's kick things off with some Hatsune Miku music as normal, and then we'll come back and we'll start talking about Diablo first up this week. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so as I said before, the first podcast section this week will be on Diablo, or more particularly Diablo clones. What was it, about 2 weeks ago now, a week ago, THQ Nordic put Titan Quest out on PlayStation 4. And I guess that kind of was the idea for this podcast, because I picked that up and remembered that it was a absolutely brilliant Diablo clone. And then I was sad because there aren't too many good ones around these days. It's like it's one of those odd kind of genres where there's Diablo itself and Diablo's amazing and everybody loves Diablo. But when it comes to other games that use that style, not a whole lot of them are particularly good. A lot of them are poorly derivative, poorly balanced, just not very interesting. It must be a tough genre, I guess, to clone. But Titan Quest is a good one, really good one. And I know you've played Titan Quest a bit, Harvard, or at least back when it was new. It's been around for quite a while now. But what are your thoughts on it?
I got it in the THQ bundle back when the company was having issues, and I didn't think much of it when I started up at the time. I was like, oh, Greek mythology, beat things up with sticks, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll play for a while. And then one thing led to another. What I find interesting about that game is it's a straight line, but in a good way. So it's a very kinetic game. You're always moving forward. You get stronger, you buy more loot, you just keep going forward. And it's not like, it doesn't feel like a crawl. It feels more like this big journey through, where you go through Greece, and you go through Egypt, and then you go through China. And I just had some Kanye West in the background. I just like pounding out hours and hours every day, just min-maxing for the longest time. It was great.
Yeah, it's certainly quite linear in design, and there's not too much incentive to go back, except you can have some good fun by jumping back to earlier parts in the game, because as you get more powerful, the damage you inflict on earlier enemies in the game is more comically extreme, I guess, and they basically fly all over the screen, and you feel like you're really powerful, and you've I guess it's a nice reward for going through all the effort and the time to get better stats and equipment and stuff. You can actually jump back to earlier parts of the game, not for any particular reason. There's no real benefit for it because the quest has progressed, but you do get to whack enemies that were previously challenging all over the place, which is fun. But yeah, I know you've played a lot of Diablo itself, Ginny. Has there ever been a clone that's kind of sung out to you as something that's different enough or interesting enough to rival Diablo?
Yes. I might be a little bit biased because it is by a New Zealand developer. I think Path of Exile is actually quite a good Diablo clone. I don't know if any of you guys have played Path of Exile. I know it was really, really big a while back, but that might have just been in New Zealand.
Was that a New Zealand game? I did not even know.
It was a Kiwi game, yes.
It's a New Zealand game.
It's the free-to-play one, isn't it?
Yeah, so it was always free-to-play. It still is free-to-play. I think some of the expansion content is like premium, but I played it for quite a bit and never actually felt like I had to spend any real money in it, because I never really got to, I guess, what was max level at the time. But I think Path of Exile did a really good job of mimicking sort of the grim, dark atmosphere of original Diablo. So instead of having it set in the whole like high fantasy, angels, demons type universe, you had it in this weird apocalyptic land afflicted by necromancy that looked a lot like New Zealand, sounded a lot like New Zealand. And it conveyed an incredible sense of hopelessness. So while in Diablo, I really enjoyed being super, super strong. And, you know, I'd fire off a bolt of magic at something and it would explode everywhere. And I'd go, yes, you know, there's my loot. You know, I feel so great and so strong. Path of Exile was the complete opposite. It was like, you are trash. You are nothing. This tiny scorpion on the beach is going to kill you in about 3 hits at level 1. You died, start again. You're an idiot. You're trash. And for some reason, while the gameplay aspects were incredibly similar, that sort of like 180 on the player dynamic was really engaging. So I come fresh off Diablo 3, being tired of the grind, and thought, right, I'll try this game out. It looks very similar. It'll be about the same. It really wasn't, apart from the mechanics of it. And I think that sort of, I guess, makes it, in my eyes, a game that I guess can rival the appeal of Diablo, just because it's so different, yet so mechanically similar. So it's a format that you're familiar with, but the storyline, the elements that they incorporate, that are sort of very Kiwiana-esque, like everything from the monsters to the local people to just, I guess, even like some of the environments as well. I find that sort of take on the Diablo formula very interesting and not so much derivative as innovative. So that's why I like Path of Exile. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I think I didn't play it. I would have played it. I think I remember seeing quite a lot about it and I was quite keen on it, but I think it was a PC only game and that held me back a bit. I'm trying to think of other examples, especially recently. There hasn't been too many good clones of Diablo. I mean, there's been a few attempts. There's like Victor Vran and another one that's also based on the same Gothica as Diablo, but they're just not as good, unfortunately.
I reviewed it a couple of years back, actually. It's called Heretic Kingdoms or something like that.
It sounds like a real Japanese name for a game. Shadows of Heretic Kingdoms.
I honestly, the name escapes me. I probably like had to Google it, but it's set in, or well, the first city was set in this kind of Arabian Middle Eastern area.
Oh. And
what I liked about it was that it had quests that put you out of the city and then drew you back into the city. So you kind of explore the world in this way. And the world building was like really, really on point. And the pace of the game was slowed down a little bit as well. So it's not so much like kill things and move on. It's like every combat encounter sort of felt like something because your swing was really weighty. You had to think about exactly when you're going to use your skills. And so it was, it's not like one of those compulsive grind games where you can just switch off and then just play forever. But it was one of more of a thinking experience. It gave you more of a narrative experience, which I really liked. Didn't play a whole lot of it, but it was good while I lasted.
Yeah, speaking of slower, I guess, Diablo-style games, the one that I got really hooked on and spent a lot of time playing was actually back on the PS3, which was Sacred 2. And Sacred 2 is effectively a Diablo clone, but it was also one by way of Elder Scrolls-style open world kind of thing. It was roughly linear, just like Elder Scrolls is, that kind of drags you from one place to the next by following the quests. But there was just an awful lot to do in each area, and there was a lot of side quests, and there was a lot of storytelling. And it was slower than Diablo as a result, because you did spend a lot of time interacting with other characters and spending a lot of time in towns and things like that, rather than just crawling through dungeon after dungeon. But I really enjoyed that one. And spent a lot of time playing it, which made me really sad when Sacred 3 turned out to be absolutely terrible. And unfortunately, the original developer behind Sacred isn't on it anymore, so that franchise has kind of been butchered and is dead, effectively, to fans. It would have been nice to have a next-gen Sacred, but we're not going to do that. So, yeah, Sacred 2 is a good one if you can pick it up. It's on PC as well, obviously, so if you've got a PC that can run it, give it a go. And yeah, I'm not sure.
Torchlight is pretty good, I think.
Well, Torchlight is good, yeah.
As a Diablo clone.
Torchlight has a good reputation. But again, it's an older game, isn't it? It's like, this is a genre that was really, really popular, about a decade ago. And there were a lot of developers doing really interesting stuff with it. Diablo itself wasn't as prominent because they were between Diablo 2 and Diablo 3, and Diablo 3 launched and was it didn't have the best launch in the world, it's safe to say. It took a while for that game to really recover itself and become what fans wanted it to be. So there seemed to be a bit of effort from other developers to fill the gap at that time. But now that Diablo 3 is firmly entrenched as the game that everybody wants to play in that genre, it seems like other developers are struggling or not really bothering it with it, which is a bit unfortunate. It's a lot of fun, that genre. when you get into it. Anyway, let's go to some music. We'll listen to all the other music in the podcast this week is from Persona 4 Dancing All Night. There's a reason for that, which we'll get to. But first up, we've got Snowflakes, which is one of Yukiko's songs from that game. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so for the second section of the podcast, we'll talk about a game that's just come out on Nintendo Switch, but it's been out on PC and whatnot for quite a while now, Shelter 2, which is, funnily enough, the sequel to Shelter. But these two games are... They're indie, obviously, so they haven't sold as well as, say, God of War, but they're better. They've really kind of been turning within the indie circle. They've been turning heads for quite a while now because they're very visually interesting, but also they have a really good, interesting theme. And it's you play as a animal in the first one. It's a badger. In the second one, it's a lynx. And obviously, the second one's the one that's on the Switch. And your job is to, I guess, guide your offspring, cubs in the lynx case, through a world that can be pretty darn hostile. You've got to feed them, you've got to make sure they survive. And while I'm still quite new to this, the Switch version is actually the first time I've played it. I understand that it's quite difficult to actually keep these cubs alive. Is that right? Am I going to be sad playing this game?
You're going to be so sad.
Very sad. I have an inability to express emotion, but I actually cry playing this game. So that's how sad it gets.
Okay. So it's, I mean, talk me through how it gets sad. Is it just that it becomes impossible to keep these animals fed? Is that it? Is that
No. So I don't know if it's the same in the second game, but I definitely played the first game, and you feel very vulnerable, especially when you're out in the open and you've got a bunch of cubs following you. And the game is very good at making the emotional punches hit really hard. So it uses mechanics like you can't really see the stuff that's trying to kill you, and then everything will go silent when you lose a cub, and then it just hits you really hard.
Right. Okay. That's because at the moment, I mean, I haven't lost any of my cubs, thank goodness, because I'm only like an hour in, and I'd be a really terrible parent if I wasn't able to keep them alive in that. I haven't come across anything too hostile yet, I guess, and it's been relatively easy to find a rabbit or two to grab for them to eat. But they keep meowing and stuff, and it's so cute, and I do want to protect them. I really do want to protect them. I'm already very attached to these cubs, yes. And you can even name them at the start. Like, you can actually give them all names, and it's like, oh, I don't know if I want to go through that. Because I did know going into it that it was obviously a survival game. That's what the name of it suggests. And then I made the assumption that it would be relatively, or I mean, it would be possible for these cubs to die, and naming them might be going a bit far. So I just used the default names. But even still, I'm very attached to these little things already. And it's such a beautiful game too. And that's, I mean, that was the kind of thing that made me want to play it. And I certainly jumped at the chance to play it on the Switch because, yeah, it's very highly, it's not very realistic, let's put it that way. It uses very sharp kind of polygonal graphics and very abstract visual design. But it's quite beautiful. I don't think there's anything quite like it out there.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And similar to what Harvard said, well, I played the second one. And I think as the first one where you play as a badger, you are a lot more helpless, I think, than playing as a lynx in number two. So it's a little bit hard to fight back against predators when you're a literal badger. So I think some of that vulnerability is displaced when you play Shelter 2, but they've shifted that sort of vulnerability more into the cubs than yourself as the parent. As someone who has played Shelter 2 probably too much, and as I just admitted to before, really embarrassingly crying a lot, they have this, you're always having to deal with predators in Shelter 2. And the difference there is, it's kind of worse losing a child when you've got the capability to protect it. So I went to it thinking, you know, Nightfall is whatever. You know, I'm not a badger this time. I'm a lynx. I've got claws. I can fight off any predators. And the inability to actually effectively protect your children from like a pack of wolves, for example, even though you think you've got it sorted, that kind of hurt me more as the lynx parent. Like, I felt more helpless knowing that I could fight maybe one or two of them off. But if my children were really threatened, I couldn't do anything about it. And losing cubs that way was quite painful. So you've got that to look forward to, Matt.
I will say, I think the game's introduction does a really good job of making you realize that you are not the all-powerful badass lynx that you might go in assuming, because I certainly assume that, you know, as a great cat, you'd be relatively capable of fighting stuff off. But the tutorial is basically you have to run away from a pack of wolves and you certainly can't stand and fight against them. And I wasn't fast enough the first time I played, so I actually lost in the tutorial because the wolves caught up with me, and that was that for my lynx. The game definitely works hard to make it feel like, even though you are at the very top of the food chain, you are still quite vulnerable. And I think that's a good story to share. That's a good message. That's it's just so, I don't know, it's hard to really kind of explain what I'm feeling at the moment playing through it, because I haven't quite got to the bit where, you know, I get emotional about it, but I'm definitely connected to the game immediately, and
Yeah. I think it's quite impressive that looking the way the game looks, which is completely basically, you know, you're doing away with all the realism that people like to see in modern games. They look like literal blocks on the screen. Everything's sort of the same shade of brown and green or white. And I think the fact that you can still sort of feel protective over these polygons, essentially, is actually really impressive, I think, on the part of the directors to foster that sense of protectiveness, whether it's through the tutorial, whereby you're sort of having to prioritize or learn to think like a mother lynx or like a parent animal or something about the game. It's just something clicks on when you're in that situation. And I mean, I'm not a mother. I don't know. You guys are probably not parents either. But it's just the ability for the game to create an environment that you're so tapped into and so protective of, despite looking the way that it looks. I think that's really impressive. And I don't know why it reviewed so awfully when it came out. Because it really is a gem, and I'm really glad that it's on the Switch. Awfully. Yeah.
It was kind of like a 7 out of 10 game for a lot of people, I think.
And that's what people were like, 2 out of 10, because it went nowhere. So I won't name the outlet, but...
I mean, I think that in terms of already I'm kind of lost to what I need to do next. So the game dumps you in the world, and it's quite open, and it doesn't really explain where you need to go or what you need to do. Which is fine for me, because that is, I mean, that's how the real world works, and you don't get markers pointing you everywhere you need to go in the real world. And this game is obviously trying to create that sense of, real world context, and it, it doesn't do a good job of pointing you where the kind of the end point of the game is, and that's the point of it. And I imagine that some critics would probably find that dull, because, or confusing, or whatever words they want to use that don't really mean anything. But I find it really interesting, because I'm also playing God of War at the moment, and God of War being that game that tries to be very realistic in its art style and stuff. And I'm much more interested in what this game is doing, Sheltered is doing, because it's prettier than God of War is, and it's more creative, and I'm certainly more connected to that game and its characters than I have been to Kratos and whatever the kid's name is, the weapon.
Hey, Matt, which game do you think is a better image of parenting, God of War or Shelter?
Well, I don't even remember the name of my kid in God of War.
Oh, Jesus.
Atreus. Did they take that from Neverending Story? I wanted to say that they got...
I'm pretty sure Atreus is like some sort of weird Hellenic spin on an old Hellenic name or something.
What's the kid's name in Neverending Story? It's pretty much the same, isn't it? Is it the same name? It's been a while since I watched Neverending Story. Anyway, I don't care about the Atreus. I think whatever. And I wouldn't want Kratos as a dad.
Oh, harsh.
It's true.
He's changed. He's no longer a criminal.
He's still a mad dude. Like, he's still cranky and shit. And you just know he drinks.
Like, yeah. Off screen? as you're loading into areas, he's just like sitting back, just throwing back some homemade moonshine or something. Like,
gotta preserve the rating.
Yeah.
Kratos, you can't do that on camera. Think of the kids.
But yeah, I mean, God of War was meant to be this game that's all about the relationship between a father and son and all of that kind of stuff. And they've certainly done a game that's all about the relationship between a father and son, but it's not. Like I said, the Shelter is so much more effective at making me care about the relationship between a parent and its offspring. And they're not even human, so. Yeah. Okay, so we'll finish up on that note. I'm going to get so many people mad at me now because I just said bad things about God of War. I like the game, I swear. I like the game. It's just a blockbuster, and that's all it is. Let's have some more music from Persona 4 Dancing All Night, and this time we'll use Pursuing My True Self, which is a Risei one, and then we'll come back and talk about just Persona 4 Dancing All Night.
Yeah. magnifying each other's charm. An ideal pairing.
You almost stole the show! That was incredible, Konami!
Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so for the last section of the podcast where we talk about one game in particular in depth, we'll talk about Persona 4 Dancing All Night this week. The reason for it being, I guess, Persona 5, Persona 3 Dancing is coming up fairly soon in Japan. I think it releases in, what, about a month? Just over a month. So, we thought we'd go back and look at one of the best rhythm games that not a whole lot of people have talked about since it came out. And I know that you've actually just started to play it in preparation of this podcast, Harvard. What are your thoughts of it so far?
I actually geeked out at how well it's designed to fit the console. So on Vita, you can actually hold it and in both hands and touch all the buttons on the touchscreen. And it just feels so natural compared to a lot of the other rhythm games, which either make you use buttons as an abstraction. Like, I know you didn't like what DJ Max, I think, did on the PS4 or something like that. And you don't have any of the problems with this one. But also, the music is really great. I didn't actually notice the music that much when I was playing Persona 4 Golden. But now just having it in front and center, and I like how it reflects the characters as well. I think it's just very well designed. I'm really surprised it didn't do that well sales-wise.
Well, it was a Vita game, and yeah. You can never expect too much by way of sales for the Vita in the West in particular. But yeah, I mean, I think that I've actually played Persona 4 Dancing All Night in the arcades in Japan as well. It was an arcade game, and I didn't realize that until I got there. And yeah, it was there, and I played around with it. And it's a really well-designed rhythm game in that it's very efficient and very neat and very clean and very easy to understand. And none of the game gets in the way of the music itself. After 5 minutes, after you play the first kind of tutorial music track, from that point on, you're not really worried about what buttons you need to press and what you need to do at this point, what you need to do at that point. You don't need to kind of play a track a couple of times in order to memorize, you know, all the mechanics in that. You can just kind of jump in and every track runs the same way. It's all very neat and presented very cleanly, and kind of none of it actually gets in the way of actually enjoying the background stuff as well, because like with the Miku games, for example, Persona 4 Dancing has full kind of music video style stuff going on in the background. And I found it really impressive the way that the developers managed to get all of the button icons and all that kind of stuff and make sure that all of that was around the edges of the screen, so that what was going on in the middle of the screen, the kind of the video clip stuff, was not being obscured by that, which was cool, because as a big fan of Persona 4 and its characters, especially Rise, it was good not to have buttons kind of, you know, obscuring her in when she's dancing along and stuff, which was good. What about you, Ginny? What are your thoughts on Persona 4 Dancing? What is it about that game that you like?
Yeah, so as a I don't want to say like an aficionado of rhythm games, but I play a hell of a lot of rhythm games. Persona 4 P4 Dan is definitely one of my favorites, and that's knowing that I've played VOAS and Demo and DJ Max and basically any other rhythm game that's come out in the past 5 years, Osu, Taiko, all that stuff. P4 Dan is one of my favorites, mainly because of what, as Matt just said, the incredibly good visual presentation. So like the whole music video style, the incredible outfits for all the characters, just the way that you could even swap out people that are going to be accompanying your chosen main dancer in songs. It's basically like a create your own music video, but with Persona 4's characters. And I found that the fact that you could play, I guess, either touchscreen or with the buttons, that was really nice. Usually I am pro touchscreen all the way, but I actually went full buttons with P4 Dan. It just felt more natural. Like, there was not a point where I looked at the controls and I was like, this is not right. This is going to be a struggle. This is going to be difficult. Everything felt very, very intuitive. So I think while the game has very satisfying difficulty levels and difficulty curves throughout the gameplay, it's never something that I had to feel like I had to, like, you know, bang my head against to get good at. Osu was a little bit like that, which kind of rewarded you for persevering and memorizing patterns. But P4 Dan is good because it's just really simple fun. And the focus really is entirely on, I think, what the franchise brings to it. And its sort of token story that it had, whereby you had to free everyone through the power of dance. So that was quite nice as well. And I mean, it's
you
good
say,
that...
You say it's... You say it's a token story, but it's actually quite in-depth, especially by rhythm game standards.
Oh yeah, for sure.
It's a good, what, from a vague recollection, it has been a while since I played the story mode. It's about a dozen hours or thereabouts.
Yeah, it's about like 10 hours worth, I think, yeah.
It's like a solid visual novel in itself.
Mm.
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of, it is basically like a visual novel with rhythm game stuff thrown in at points just to keep you awake, I guess. But it tells a good story. It's a good continuation. It takes place at the end of Persona 4. So what happens afterwards? And there's a, because it, this is a big spoiler, but at the end of Persona 4, kind of.
Oh no,
Harvard, close your ears. At the end of Persona 4, everybody kind of goes their own way. And particularly the lead character, Yu.
Yeah.
That's Y-U, not Y-O-U, although.
That's the joke.
That's the joke, yes. Anyway, Yu goes back to wherever he came from. And then Persona 4 Dancing happens, and there's an excuse for everybody to kind of all come together again. Mm. They're all a little bit older, a little bit more mature. So Yosuke's not quite as much of a dick. And, you know, Rise's now gone back, and she's a super popular idol again, which is good and true and how things should be. And yeah, then stuff happens and they need to go back into the shadow world, and instead of fighting stuff via RPG combat, now they need to fight stuff by, you know, breaking out some cool moves. And it's good. It works really well. It's surprisingly well done as a sequel to what is one of the best video game narratives ever made. And that's a really impressive effort, because that can't have been easy to do. The only thing they got wrong was, I guess, they couldn't, and it wasn't really their fault, I guess, they couldn't lock down Rise's voice actor again. So they got somebody to try and impersonate her voice, and it sounds a little bit odd at times, unfortunately. Pretty good effort overall, but yeah.
Yeah, still quite impressive that it's fully voiced, though. It is, like, yeah. All the story portions, just full dialogue. Incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like how thematically the game is an extension of Persona 4 as well. So Persona 4 was all about kind of Jungian, who are you and who do you want to be and who are you trying to repress? And then Persona 4 Dancing is all about who others think you are and whether you should become what others think of you. And so I feel like that's thematically, it's like a step above, so a step away from what the original game was about, but it still explores that same idea in the lens of being a teenager and idol culture and celebrity culture, especially. It gets really deep for something that's supposed to be just like a fan service rhythm game.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, if you do ever get a chance to play Persona 4 Dancing All Night, I certainly recommend actually going into the story mode. I know you can basically actually unlock everything anyway, but just playing the rhythm game part of it as a separate thing. But so I think it's a bit like the fighting games where a lot of people skip past the story if they can and just get to the action. But with this one, I do recommend taking the time to experience that story, especially if you are a fan of Persona, because yeah, it's surprisingly good. I'll tell you one thing that I found I was quite annoyed with, I guess, at first with Persona 4 Dancing All Night, was the fact that each of the music tracks is actually locked to a character. Like, I did play Persona 4 coming off the Miku games, where I was used to being able to put Miku into the video clip regardless of who was actually doing the singing. Yeah, I didn't use basically any of the other Vocaloids. I just had Miku there, and it looked a little bit odd when she was singing like Kato and sounding like a dude. But I do what I do.
Semantics. It's gonna do what you gotta do.
But you know, I like Hatsune Miku. I'm not such a huge fan of, you know, looking at Kato. So, yeah, I like that freedom that the Miku games offered. And then going to Persona 4 Dancing, I was trying to put Risa into everything and I couldn't. And I was very upset by this because, you know, I might like a Yosuke song and I just don't want to look at the guy. But unfortunately, I have to.
The backup dancer that pops in where you get like a perfect, you know, score during the interlude and do the weird little duo dance together.
You can definitely do that, and that's good. It's good to be able to have Risa as the backup dancer. But, you know, you're still looking at Yosuke for the rest of it, and I just, that annoyed me so much at first because there were some tracks that I really liked and I just didn't play them as much because, and then the characters that you did like, you ended up with only, you know, three or four different tracks that they were in as the lead dancer. So, yeah, but the more I played it, the more I realized that there was a reason. Yeah, it was probably for the better cohesiveness of the overall game that the characters were locked. So I don't mind it so much now, I guess. I am looking forward to, funnily enough, the PlayStation 4 version of Persona 4 Dancing All Night more than I'm looking forward to the Persona 3 and Persona 5 dancing games. Because in Japan, you can order the pack, the super limited edition, ultra bonus, whatever they've called it. And you get a code to download Persona 4 Dancing All Night as well. And that's the only way to get it. So you've got to order the super, super duper limited edition to actually get a copy of this game. They're never going to release it otherwise. And I kind of sort of actually shelled out for it because I wanted that download code. Because, yeah, I want Risa on my big TV. In the Arabian armor. DLC. The costumes. The costumes are so good in this game.
Oh, yeah. You can change the costumes every song. So take advantage of that, everyone.
And there's a good mix of costumes, too. It's like, it's a bunch of stuff from Persona 4 itself. Gym clothes and uniforms and whatever.
The Velvet Room outfits as well.
Yeah, the Velvet Room outfits. And then you've got some really crazy and super fan servicey ones as well. Like
the butler costumes.
The butler costumes. Arabian armor for Risa. Yukiko's got Greek goddess armor costume thing. Is that?
I guess it kind of looks like that. I don't know. It's.
I don't know what it's called, but it looks like. Yeah,
Colosseum inspired Greek maiden type, thing.
Yeah, Yep. And no pants. Basically, it was a no pants costume.
The best of the costumes. No pants.
And then Kanji and his budgie smugglers. That's
yeah. Cool. Hashtag Tony Abbott style.
Yeah, but he actually pulls it off. Kanji, I mean, not Tony Abbott.
Yeah, not Tony Abbott. Great disclaimer there.
But yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have unlocked too many of the costumes yet, Harvard, but playing dress up with the characters is is definitely
keep going.
It's good fun.
Oh, that was definitely a thing in the original Persona game as well, because you could change costumes in that game, and unlocking costumes was like the most important thing, more than beating the story.
What? You could. I didn't. Oh, no, that's right, because Persona 4, once I had the swimsuits, I didn't actually change costumes again, so I kind of forgot that you could change costumes, and it just started to make all sense that, they're, you know, in these dungeons fighting these enemies, and they're all just wearing, you know, summer beach wear.
In case, like, there's a swimming pool in the dungeon or something.
Yeah, just in case you defeat a pool-based monster, you know, you never know. You never know. It's called being practical.
However, that's how I play pretty much all JRPGs. I'm just telling you that.
If there's a maid outfit, I'm gonna find it and put it on my character.
just hang out and, you know, when you get a JRPG, when a new one's out, just wait for the inevitable swimsuit DLC, and that's when you start playing it, not before. But anyway, yes, Persona 4 Dancing All Night, it is unfortunately only a PlayStation Vita exclusive, so you do need to have one of those if you want to play it, which is unfortunate because I think a lot of people in the West don't have one. Or alternatively, you can order the Super Duper Ultra Limited Bonus Funky, whatever they call it, pack of Persona 3 and Persona 5 Dancing from Japan, and then you'll get a download code for Persona 4 Dancing All Night as well, which is cool. I really recommend it. Plus, I'm looking forward to Persona 5 Dancing. I don't know about Persona 3. I don't care.
I don't remember
much of the music from Persona 3 anymore.
It was. I vaguely remember it being okay, but I think that's pretty much my memories of the entire game.
It was fine. I quite liked it. I remember that it was more than fine, but the music just, I can't think back to it now. I just can't remember anything that really stood out.
About the only thing I remember from Persona 3 that I liked was there was a dog.
Jesus.
And I'm pretty sure the dog won't be dancing in Persona 3 Dancing.
Or
if he is, that would be pretty cool.
He could be like a backup dancer. That'd be really nice.
I always get yelled at when I say I don't care much for Persona 3, but I just don't. But Persona 5 has good music. That should be good. And
All right. The cat suit.
Anne's a special person. On that note, we'll head off and finish up the podcast for this week. Thank you very much for listening, as always. Thanks for being on, Harvard and Ginny.
No worries.
And we'll finish things up with one more track from Time to Make History, which is a good one.
Yes.
Thanks very much for watching. The rules pretty cool, got an app in the face of the Sabbath street. When your friends and boss look alike on the face of it, they miss the history, but they fight all the place in it. Yeah, they fight all the place in it. How did five times the chance have the love goes by? I know it's natural to say, but there ain't no other way. Time to
イザナギ